This is a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
You're tuned into R1 News at 1. Every weekday from 1 till 2 p.m, our dedicated news team brings you the hard-hitting stories, interviews and culture pieces from across Otepoti, Dunedin.
You're listening to R1 News at 1. I'm Jonah. Stay tuned for the headlines of the day.
Here are the R1 News at 1 headlines.
This is the R1 News Bulletin for Thursday, 25th of July. I'm Jonah. In national news, the government's Māori Ward Amendments Bill has passed its second reading in Parliament yesterday, RNZ reports. The full name of the bill is the Local Government Electoral Legislation and Māori Wards and Māori Constituencies Amendment Bill. It reverses legislation passed by Labour in 2021 that abolished the requirement for a referendum to establish Māori wards and constituencies on local councils. Māori wards are similar to Māori electorates in Parliament and allow for councils to have guaranteed Māori representation at the local level. The reintroduction of the referendum requirement appeared in National's coalition agreements with both New Zealand First and ACT. Local Government Minister Simeon Brown cited a need to, quote, to scrap the, quote, divisive changes made by the previous Labour government. During a debate in Parliament on the bill on Tuesday, Labour Party MP Shanann Halbert accused the government of, quote, taking New Zealand race relations backwards by a decade. Dr. Duncan Wim, another Labour Party MP, said that the bill was a retrograde step. The bill passed its second reading vote with 68 ayes and 55 noes. In international news, last Sunday, U.S. President Joe Biden dropped out of the U.S. presidential election. The New York Times reports, after several weeks of relentless pressure from key allies and Democratic Party donors, Biden, 81, has given up his bid for re-election, endorsing his vice president, Kamala Harris, to run in his place. The pressure on President Biden came from concerns that the president is too old and frail to defeat Donald Trump in this year's election. Such concerns were magnified by Biden's debate with Trump on 27th of June, which was widely perceived to be a disaster for Biden. Despite Biden's insistence that he would continue his re-election campaign, the pressure appears to have been insurmountable, resulting in Biden's announcement on Sunday. In a statement, Biden said that it had been his intention to seek a re-election, but that standing down was in the best interest of the country and the Democratic Party. In a subsequent online statement, Biden said that he had offered his, quote, full endorsement and support for Kamala. He called for Democrats to, quote, come together and beat Trump. It is unprecedented for a sitting president to drop out of the race so late in the election cycle. Later in the show, we'll be joined by Jeffrey Miller, an international geopolitics expert, who will discuss these developments in the U.S. and their implications for global affairs. Stay tuned. In Otepoti news, two events in support of Kanaki in New Caledonia have been organized by Tini Fetu Project Space for this weekend. On Friday, a fundraising event will be held at Yours on Upper Murray from 4:30 to 6 p.m. with stalls, music, and live poetry writing. Alongside this, there will be an online art auction running till next Monday. Some of the art will be available for viewing on Friday night, and the full catalogue up for auction can be perused via Tini Fetu's Instagram. On Saturday, the weekly Free Palestine Rally will be held in solidarity with Kanaki. The rally meets outside the Otago Museum Reserve at 1 p.m. and walks to the Octagon for speeches at about 2 p.m. Kanak is the collective term for the indigenous people of New Caledonia, who were colonized by the French in 1853. There is currently ongoing conflict in New Caledonia between pro-independence protesters and state security forces, stemming from referendums on New Caledonia's autonomy. This has led to an increased French military presence in New Caledonia since May, and 10 deaths, as reported by RNZ. And in student news, the two nominees for OUSA Exec's new finance and strategy officer have been announced. Daniel Leamy and Joel Tabs will be running for the role. The by-election will take place next week, from 9 a.m. Monday to 4 p.m. Wednesday, via electronic voting. Their campaign period starts now. This has been the R1 News Bulletin for Thursday, 25th of July. Today's bulletin was written by Jonah Broughton and Jemima Lorimer, and read to you by Jonah Broughton. Next up, we've got Pity Party by Fanfic. That was When I Land by Cruise Control. Today we're joined by Jeffrey Miller, an international geopolitical analyst for the Democracy Project, a think tank at Wellington's Victoria University, and he's currently undertaking a PhD in politics here at Otago. We'll be talking about some of the most recent developments in the build-up to the US election and the implications of that globally. Thanks very much for joining us, Jeffrey.
Thank you very much for inviting me on, Jonah. great to be here.
So, to start off with, I'll ask, what are the likely implications of the Trump assassination attempt in your eyes? Has it boosted his popularity?
It's funny, it almost seems so long ago, just given all the developments that we've had in US politics since then. It was only, 10 days ago. But since then we've had, of course, Joe Biden's decision to step out of the race. And that's really then dominated the news cycle. I think it did probably open up Trump to a segment of voters who had very much turned against him and were not interested really in anything Trump had to say. And the fact that Trump was so dramatically targeted by this assassination attempt, it was the first assassination attempt since 1981 when Ronald Reagan was wounded in an assassination attempt. So I think it was very shocking. It was one of these dramatic moments. But I don't think it's probably really moved the needle. When you look at the polls, there was a new poll that came out yesterday with Harris versus Trump, and she's leading Trump 44-42 in nationwide polls. So there doesn't seem to have been any sympathy bump towards Trump, and maybe US voters are just simply so polarized that even something as dramatic as an assassination attempt doesn't really change views overly. It probably hardens the resolve of Trump's base and his supporters. They're perhaps even more firmly behind him than they were before, but maybe it's not something that's going to necessarily engender a whole lot of new support and bring in a whole lot of new voters to the Trump camp.
So we already touched on Biden withdrawing from the race, which is the big news of this week. Going over to the other side with Biden, what do you think his legacy will be when, you know, future historians write about this time?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this. Of course, you've got to split this into, I guess, domestic policy achievements and foreign policy. You know, here in New Zealand, we're probably more interested in the foreign policy side of things. Domestically, Biden would point to the strong stock market, the economic growth, the fact that he avoided a recession, low unemployment. It's overall a pretty good economic record. That said, when it comes down to it, inequality in the US has not improved. Despite all the subsidies during the COVID period, inequality has only got worse over that period. Inflation has been a huge battle internationally and in the US as well, and that has meant that people at the bottom don't feel that they're any better off. So while the Biden campaign has kept pointing to the fact that the economy is booming and is doing so well, I think people at the bottom are not really feeling it so much, and that's been one of the struggles of the Democrats this year. But you know, Biden has introduced legislation like the Inflation Reduction Act, which came out of the Build Back Better program that he started when he came into the presidency back in 2021. And that's got a whole lot of infrastructure spending on renewable energy and so forth, and some healthcare improvements, reducing drug prices and so forth. So that's the domestic side. But on the foreign policy side, I think, you know, it comes down to a few things. Ukraine is a big one, and bringing NATO together. And I think probably when Biden looks to his finest moments, he'll probably see that those months over Ukraine back in February 2022, when the US was really going very strongly, was standing very strongly behind Ukraine and bringing NATO leaders together at a time when there actually wasn't necessarily that sentiment initially. It was seen that it would be a walkover for Putin and that Russia would easily conquer a lot of Ukraine, and Biden stood up to that notion and stood behind Volodymyr Zelensky. So Ukraine is one of them. Then, of course, China. Largely, Joe Biden continued Donald Trump's policies towards China. He changed tone, perhaps, but it's been a very fractious relationship with China over the past 4 years. You wouldn't say that things are really much better in terms of overall relations between the US and China than they were under the Trump presidency. Joe Biden has set up a whole lot of new institutions to combat China, whether it's the Partners in the Blue Pacific or AUKUS or a number of other vehicles, the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. So he's really institutionalized, if you like, some of this anti-China architecture, and that will no doubt endure a lot of it. But then, of course, you've got what's happened in Gaza, and that's probably the most problematic aspect of Joe Biden's legacy. He stood very firmly behind Israel at the beginning and kept emphasizing last October Israel has the right to defend itself, which I think Israel did, given the attack that was perpetrated by Hamas. And yet Israel just made things a thousand times worse with its response, in the fact that 38,000, 39,000, I think, almost civilians have now been killed, or a large number of them, the vast majority are civilians, especially women and children. And it's a festering sore. It's something that has not been resolved yet. There's some talk of a ceasefire, but I wouldn't be holding my breath that there will be a long-lasting, sustainable solution to the war in Gaza by the end of Joe Biden's presidency. It's probably something that's going to spill over into the next presidency for whoever's in the White House.
Mm. And how much of what we're seeing in Gaza can we sort of blame Joe Biden for, or attribute that to his, you know, kind of funding and support for Israel?
It's a hard one, really. Of course, Joe Biden didn't start the war. He didn't ask for the war, and he didn't want to be in the Middle East. Joe Biden had really tried to stay out of getting sucked into the Middle East, as he would see it, because he wanted to focus on the Indo-Pacific, on China, on New Zealand's part of the world, to be honest, and Ukraine. I mean, he didn't ask for Ukraine either, but that came up. But he certainly didn't want to get involved again in the Middle East. If you recall the evacuations from Afghanistan in 2021, which were pretty disastrous. He wanted to get out of that region overall, but he was brought back in, and he's not to blame for it, but I think you can certainly put quite a bit of responsibility on Joe Biden for the way that the war has evolved since October the 7th. In the end, the US has stood strongly behind Israel and has continued to send weaponry, with some exceptions. They did suspend the 2,000 pound and 500 pound bombs back in May this year over frustration over what Israel was doing, although they've just resumed the 500 pound ones. But there's a whole range of other weaponry and arms that the US has been sending Israel's way. I mean, that's part of their long-standing arrangement to supply Israel with the weapons it needs to defend itself. I think there is that Joe Biden could have spoken up sooner and more strongly and more firmly against what was happening. I think it's just been too slow, and he's let Benjamin Netanyahu get away with too much overall. And only the US really has the leverage over Israel. So if Joe Biden's not going to do it, no one else really can. And you know, that will go down as a stain, I guess, a black mark on Joe Biden's presidency, the fact that he wasn't able to bring this war to a conclusion, and that it's just gone on for so long with so much harm caused to civilians.
And in light of all that, there's been quite a lot of anger with Joe Biden among certain sections of the US electorate. Do you think that's likely to sort of tone down, dissipate with Kamala Harris becoming the nominee or not?
Look, sadly, the war in Gaza is already fading from view, and that happens with wars. It's happened with Ukraine as well. You know, we're 9 months into the war in Gaza. It was front page news and was very much front and center for quite a few months. But I think the last 3 or 4 months, it's really faded. After what we saw back in April, or end of March, I think it was, the attacks on the World Central Kitchen, or the Israeli bombing mistakenly targeted humanitarian aid workers. I think after that point, the world, in a way, gradually shifted its focus. You had those range of student protests at US college campuses back in April and early May. And now you don't really actually read much about what's happening in Gaza. I mean, there was a Israeli bombing in Khan Yunis a couple of days ago. It killed 70 people. It was pretty substantial, but you didn't really see much of it, because we're now very much focused on the palace politics of who's going to replace Joe Biden and everything that's happening with the US presidential election race. So I don't think that Gaza, sadly, will be a major issue of the US election campaign. It should be, but I think we're going to see a limited ceasefire soon that will probably reduce attention to the war even further, even though it won't be a longer-lasting political solution at all. It won't be the two-state solution. It won't be a permanent ceasefire or a permanent peace deal. It will do nothing with regards to the permanent arrangements in Gaza, but it will get it off the front page and get it off the agenda. I think Kamala Harris will be pleased about that, because I don't think she'll be wanting to talk about it overly either. It's a difficult issue for Democrats, because they want to show support to both sides, essentially, not supporting Israel is a losing game when you're trying to get swing centrist voters from the Republican camp, and equally not showing sympathy and empathy for the Palestinian civilians who are being killed as a losing game, especially when you're trying to appeal to younger voters who came out in force in some of those college campuses. So I think Kamala Harris will be just keen not to talk about it, and sadly that's going to be the detriment of Palestinians.
And how do you rate Harris's chances in general against Trump? You already mentioned that one poll has her beating him. Do you think that's a trend that will continue to show?
Look, it's 50-50. When you look at the underlying economic indicators, it should favour an incumbent being re-elected. I mean, Kamala Harris is an incumbent in a sense, because she's the current vice president. So all the indicators should normally point towards an easy second term for whoever's in the White House at this point, if going by history. But we're not really in a usual time, are we, with Donald Trump? He's not a usual candidate. And this is, in the end, the big question. I guess it's 50-50 in the end whether Harris can do it. I think she's brought change. It's an unexpected change. I think a lot of voters will be reevaluating their opinions. They'd probably thought Biden or Trump, I hate both options. Now they'll be thinking, Harris, I don't really know much about her. I want to find out and see what she says first, and then I'll make a decision. So it opens things up again, and it might encourage voters in those swing states to take a second look at the Democratic camp and to consider perhaps voting for Kamala Harris over Donald Trump. So in the end, the US elections, they're not a popular vote across the 50 states. They're really decided in no more than about 10 states, those battleground states, Wisconsin, Georgia, and Nevada, and Pennsylvania. And so in the end, it will depend very much on what voters in those states think. And a very small group of voters in the end in those states, the ones that could go either way in the middle. And that's who that Kamala Harris will be trying to appeal to, those center voters in the end, and to try and get them on side.
Do you think it matters to the American electorate, rather, that Kamala Harris is a woman of color and substantially younger than Trump as well and Biden as well?
I think the generational difference does matter. I think when you have a very old candidate versus a younger candidate, it's easier when elections are so often about the future. They're all about what you're promising in the future. It's easier for the younger candidate to typically make their case that, I'm the next generation, it's time for you to make way for me. And if you think of the previous examples of that, you can think of Barack Obama versus John McCain. You can think of, in the New Zealand context, Helen Clark versus John Key, the fresh-faced challenger versus the older candidate. When you've got these different generations, that will be in Kamala Harris's favour to an extent. When it comes to ethnicity, I think it will probably largely be a non-issue, which will be refreshing if I'm correct on that. There was a lot of ink spilt and a lot of discussions had back in 2008 when Barack Obama was the Democratic nominee, whether American voters would be willing to vote for a black man in the White House. In the end, they did. And it wasn't the big issue, perhaps, that it was made out to be. That's the big question, whether, the U.S. is ready for its first woman president, and a woman of color. I hope they will. In a sense, I hope that it's not an issue in the debate, and that In the end, it comes down to what both candidates are promising and what their policies are. It would be good if the decisions are made on policies, not on identity, and if voters were able to weigh up their choices and make the decisions accordingly. In the end, personality always comes down to it. You're voting for a person, and temperament is a huge part of it, and I think Harris will be keen to really point out that she's not Trump, because in the end that's probably her best card to play. If you don't like Trump, vote for me. And I think that will probably still resonate with a lot of voters. It's a good card to play with a very polarizing candidate like Donald Trump.
And shifting back to foreign policy and global affairs, what would be the impact of a second Trump presidency on global affairs?
We will see an America First foreign policy once again. Exactly what that means, we'll have to see. It will mean an unwinding of the war in Ukraine, but that's going to happen really whoever's in the White House. I think it's quite clear that the high levels of funding and support for Ukraine just will not go on indefinitely. Germany has already set out a budget cutting its aid to Ukraine by about half. I think all NATO countries will be keen to follow suit and bring the war to some kind of negotiated settlement. Trump will be keener perhaps than most. I don't think he's invested in Ukraine at all. He'll be keen to get that over and done with. When it comes to elsewhere, I think he's going to continue very much the anti-China strategy. I mean, Donald Trump started that back in 2015 when he was a candidate. So the anti-China rhetoric will only ramp up a notch. I think it will change in tone. In substance, I think a lot of these things will endure from the Biden administration. The AUKUS, I think, will endure, and some of these other vehicles that the US has established. But I think there will perhaps be less of a willingness to entertain that US involvement in the Pacific is all about climate change and is all about helping Pacific countries. I think Donald Trump will be much more willing to simply say this is about countering China and stopping China's aggression as we see it in the Pacific, and to try and stop China getting footholds in the Pacific, because that's in the end why the US, why New Zealand, Australia, other countries are suddenly so involved in the Pacific. It's not really because they're interested in climate change. Let's be honest here in the end. I mean, it's great if Pacific countries benefit from it, and they are, because there's a lot of money going into things like climate change. But I don't think that's really what the motivating factor here is. The motivating factor here is that Western countries are worried that China is going to establish military bases in the Pacific. So suddenly they're paying a lot of attention to the region. So I think Trump will continue with that to the extent that it is part of his anti-China campaign. Then that leaves the Middle East, and I think Donald Trump will be backing Israel to the hilt on everything, and I think this is part of Benjamin Netanyahu's calculus. If he can just survive for another 6 months, he could end up with Donald Trump in the White House and backing him up and not demanding that Israel remove its settlements and make peace with the Palestinians. A Donald Trump White House is very unlikely to push Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israelis hard to any degree, and so I think Netanyahu will be trying to stay on for another 6 months and hope that Donald Trump saves his approach to the Palestinians.
And with regard to the Middle East, so just earlier this week we witnessed Israel launching an airstrike on a Houthi target in Yemen, and this was in response to the Houthis launching a drone strike in Tel Aviv. In light of this, first off, could you explain sort of what's going on there? And in light of that, should we be worried about wider regional escalation in the Middle East?
Sure. Yeah, the Houthi rebels in Yemen have sent around 200 rockets and drones towards Israel since the war began on October the 7th, the war in Gaza. It's a long distance. You know, for any listeners out there, I looked up the distance between Hodeidah, the port that the Israelis struck, and Tel Aviv. It's about the same length as New Zealand. It's about 1,700 kilometres. So it's a long way, but you can send drones a long way. Most of them, and all of them up till this point, had been deflected by the Israelis' missile defence systems. Remember, they get obviously a lot of warning because of the distance that they're coming from. But this one got through that killed an Israeli civilian. And then Israel responded by striking back and bombing the port of Hodeidah on the western side of Yemen. And look, in the end, the war in Gaza really set a chain of very unfortunate events in motion. And one of the outcomes, one aspect of the fallout was the Houthis really getting behind their Palestinian brothers, as they would see it, and supporting them. And so they undertook a large number of attacks against commercial ships in the Red Sea. That's why most ships now avoid the Suez Canal and they go around the Cape of Good Hope, they go around the continent of Africa and avoid that region. But there have been just a large number of solidarity attacks from Yemen. Then you've got to recall the overall context in that the Houthis are allied with Iran, and the drone that was used to attack Tel Aviv was an Iranian drone. So these Iranian weapons are coming into Yemen. That's where the Houthis get their weapons for, not just for attacking Israel, but in the civil war as a whole. They are a client of Iran. And so that's the regional aspect of it all. And you just think back to April when you had a tit-for-tat exchange of missiles and rockets between Iran and Israel. We came very close to, you know, an ongoing direct confrontation between Israel and Iran. It stopped after those initial exchange of fire over 2 or 3 days, fortunately for the world's sake. But there's a real risk that this war escalates into a wider regional conflict, that it's no longer just about the war in Gaza. You've got to remember that Iran also supplies Hezbollah, which is in Lebanon, to Israel's north. And Hezbollah has 150,000 rockets and upwards of 50,000 fighters. They're very well armed, much better armed than, say, the Houthis. They're much closer as well. And you've had direct wars between Israel and Lebanon in the past. And so there's been a large number of rockets exchanged across the border between Israel and the Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, and there's a real risk this could spill over at some point and become a second front in the war, and that Israel is not just dealing with Gaza in the south, but Lebanon in the north. And then you add into the mix the Houthis in Yemen. What do they do, and what Iran is doing itself, and that would be the nightmare scenario, that you end up with a head-to-head direct conflict between Iran and Israel, with others in support of Iran, of the Houthis, and from Hezbollah. So that would be the nightmare scenario, and it would lead to others becoming involved. The United States, European countries would inevitably become involved, and so would New Zealand. New Zealand already is involved. We've got troops in the Middle East combating these attacks on commercial ships in the Red Sea. So it's a nightmare scenario, and this is why everyone needs to be working for a permanent ceasefire and a longer lasting two-state solution in Palestine, because it is a cancer that infects the whole region, and the longer this remains an unresolved conflict, the more likely is that we're going to see just a wider conflict that leads to, you know, many lives being lost. So that's why there should be an urgency to getting a resolution in this conflict, because of the potential fallout. It's grim. It is a powder keg, and you know, the longer this war goes on, the more risk it is that it explodes.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your insight. That was a really fascinating chat. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for the invitation, Jonah. It's been really good talking to you about so many issues.
Yeah, well, we'll just wrap up now, and next up we've got Lost by Meg Theron.
know when you're in it. Open my eyes, but I lost all the vision. The mission ain't bound by my worldly decisions.
Whoa, so crazy, what you gonna do? Cause the world gonna hate me. Whoa, I realized lately, nothing you can do when the world gonna hate me.
Yeah, all truth when I answer the call. Only as strong as how far I can fall. Only as great as the battles we face. Dream of the future or nothing at all.
Whoa, so crazy, what you gonna do? Cause the world gonna hate me. Whoa, I realized lately, nothing you can do when the world gonna hate me.
Lost in the place that I thought could have shown me the path that would lead me back to you. I've been so lost in the place that I thought could have shown me the path that would lead me back to you, back to you. I don't
You've been listening to R1 News at 1, here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. The R1 News is uploaded daily wherever you get your podcasts. Or head to r1.co.nz/news to get yourself all caught up. Additionally, you can follow R1 News NZ to keep up to date with all our newsworthy happenings.
Thanks very much for tuning in to R1 News at 1. Today we had Jeffrey Miller in to talk about the Middle East and the US election. And next up we've got Hello My Dear by Marlon Streaming.
Hello my dear.
Dear New Zealand on air, without you we are nothing.
Thanks for listening to Radio 1 91 FM podcast. All of our content lives online at r1.co.nz.